Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And, Jim, I'm just glad to see that you're okay. And I'm glad that I was able to get into work because Snowmageddon 2017 finally hit in March. And, Jim, I could barely see the top of my grass this morning. School is canceled and probably will be again tomorrow.
Yeah, I point out I'm not that mad at the weatherman, Greg, because Doug Kammerer at NBC and all these other guys, in their defense, they were using the numbers from the Congressional Budget Office, which projected that we could get anything from 0 to 294 inches of snow, and that an ice age would kick in around 2020 and the return of the woolly mammoth. So it didn't quite work out that way. You know, there's snow. This is, you know, you've listeners of the Three Martini Lunch have heard me griping about ridiculous school day snow closures. Today it wasn't ridiculous. I think if they're closed tomorrow, it will be ridiculous. And let's see if the text from Authenticity Woods Public Schools comes through during this podcast.
Wouldn't be the first time. Good luck to those friends of ours a little bit north of us, all the way up into New England. The storm definitely more serious up there. For those around the D.C. area, hope you're enjoying the day off if you got one. Let's also point out to folks, we're sponsored today by ZipRecruiter. Right now, Three Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. Jim, let's start with the good martini and with all the news we've had in the last few weeks, from Trump and Russia to Obama wiretapping Trump to the Republican version of the health care bill, which we'll talk about a little bit later, to all these different issues that have come up, controversial, non-controversial, policy, media-related. You know what we haven't talked about in a long time is Neil Gorsuch. He is the president's nominee to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. It's been vacant over a year now since the death of Antonin Scalia. And Monday, I believe, marks the start of the Senate Judiciary Committee's confirmation hearings. And there's really good news for conservatives. The Democrats still have no idea what to do about this. Here is Ed Morrissey at Hot Air. Senate Democrats have not been able to figure out how they should respond in the 6 weeks following the pick and are paralyzed by Gorsuch's stellar record on the appellate bench. Then he cites Politico. President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee has breezed through more than 70 meetings with senators. Opponents who have scoured his record have found little to latch onto, and some Democrats are privately beginning to believe that Gorsuch, barring a blunder at his Senate confirmation hearings next week, will clinch the 60 votes he needs to be approved without a filibuster. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York has been taking the temperature of the Senate Democratic caucus, but hasn't begun whipping hard against Gorsuch, sources familiar with the matter said. Indeed, despite anger from the Democratic base that senators have cowered from a fight against Trump's high court pick, the sole strategic decision the Democratic caucus has made about Gorsuch ahead of his confirmation hearings is to make no decision at all. Jim, that's about as good as we could have hoped for. We know that there were at least 8 or 9 Democrats, maybe even more, which is how many we need to get to 60 to avoid the filibuster showdown, saying that Gorsuch deserved the up or down vote. And after weeks and weeks of scouring, it's pretty obvious they got nothing on this guy.
Yeah. I guess there's a small, slim chance that they found something really scandalous and shocking that they'll unveil at the hearing. But I'm rather skeptical of that scenario. Look, it's okay, listeners, if you're looking at this thing, Neil Gorsuch, wasn't he already on the court? Didn't we? I mean, you were talking about this is the least dramatic confirmation process we've had in quite some time. I think he's met with 70-some senators, does the nice little photo op. They sit down on the couch and they chat and, you know, everybody comes out and says what an impressive fellow he is, even the Democrats. There is not an easy option for Democrats here. There is not an easy argument against Gorsuch here. Everybody agrees he's completely qualified. And most people who are honest observers, even if they're not on the right, will observe that when it comes to judges, he is a particularly clear thinker, clear writer, great insight into the way the laws ought to be, undoubtedly a man of the right. Different terms have been thrown around, whether he's an originalist, strict constructionist. But he seems like a perfect replacement for Scalia from the eyes of most conservatives. So if you're a Democrat, you don't have the obvious, this man is unqualified because of X. Then the next best thing is look at his extreme decision on why. He doesn't even make that many decisions that they can use as a convenient stick to hit him on the head with. They're kind of just flailing around looking for things. And I saw an op-ed, I believe it was in the Philadelphia Inquirer earlier today, who basically said Democrats have an obligation to stop Neil Gorsuch, and by golly, his confirmation would be unconstitutional. Not because of anything Gorsuch has done, but because it was really unfair that Merrick Garland didn't get confirmed onto the court. Now, what I can understand on some level, the grievances and the aggravation that Merrick Garland didn't even get a hearing. But, Greg, let's all imagine a scenario in which he gets the hearing. Republican-controlled Senate holds the hearings, and the Republican-controlled Senate rejects him. Well, then we're back to square one. And, you know, you could repeat this process as long as you like throughout the process of 2016. The Senate, the Constitution says the Senate has advise and consent for the president's nominee. It doesn't really specify anything about how that advise and consent process has to occur. And in this circumstance, the Republicans in the Senate did not consent to Merrick Garland. He's a very nice man and a distinguished enough career, but they didn't like the idea of replacing a justice of one philosophy with a completely different philosophy. Well, this really irks this law professor writing in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And he says, because of this, every decision from Neil Gorsuch will be tainted. Because of what Senate Republicans did for the Merrick Garland. It doesn't really work that way. So when this is your big argument, last year was really unfair. It's not going to move that many people. I think, you know, unless the attitude of Democrats is we will block any Trump nominee for the next 4 years. We didn't, you know, if you guys like having eight justices, fine. We'll have eight justices for the rest of Trump terms. As long as Ruth Bader Ginsburg is feeling healthy. Because then it would be down to seven justices. We could really trim the Supreme Court if they want to play hardball on us. My sneaking suspicion is that they don't. And as you know, it's you that that Politico story and Ed Morrissey observed. This is, you know, look, if you want, for shorthand, we'll just call Scalia a conservative justice. This is replacing a conservative justice with another conservative justice. It's not really going to change that much on the Supreme Court. The bigger fight will come when Kennedy retires or Ginsburg retires or any other one of those justices retires and Trump nominates another conservative judge to replace him. That's the, you know, judicial Armageddon. That is Ragnarok. That is, you know, maybe I should say Ragnarok and roll. That is when it's going to be the big fight over, you know, the philosophy of the court, and the consequences will be huge. So if you're a Senate Democrat, do you use the filibuster and lose that fight and lose the filibuster for the duration of when you got probably forever, you know, for the duration certainly of when Republicans are in charge? Do you want to lose it now, or do you want to lose it later? Maybe you want to hold on to it now, which means you don't use it now, which means they don't have to require it to get to six, you know, to eliminate the 60 vote threshold. There's no good option for Democrats in this case, which probably is a good metaphor, good way to lead into our second martini, because sometimes life doesn't give you any good options. The opposition party will know a lot about that in this next issue. But for now, Democrats are just going to flail. And Neil Gorsuch looks like he should be joining the other eight sometime in the coming months.
Yeah, certainly sounds good. Mitch McConnell says he wants to see him confirmed by the time the April recess comes around, which is only about a month away. So that would be pretty quick. Jim, based on the Democratic law professor's logic, I guess that means we can ignore any decision Anthony Kennedy made that Robert Bork would have disagreed with.
And, ooh, I like that.
Yeah,
yes.
I think we could have some fun with that. And how much do you want to bet that most of the gotcha questions will involve Trump and Jeff Sessions rather than anything Neil Gorsuch has done?
Yeah, and you know, Gorsuch will probably give you. If I'm Gorsuch, I just shrug at every question. I just met the guy. He likes me. That's all I can say, you know.
If you haven't been with us since the confirmation process began, the Jim Garrity School of Confirmation hearing etiquette for the nominee is pretty much just say yeah and nod and shrug your shoulders and say sure, whatever.
Yeah, sure, whatever would be the universal Garrity response to all inquiries from all Democratic senators. But don't you think President Trump has committed impeachable offenses? Sure, whatever, right? You know, I'm not going to preside over the impeachment hearings. If you go with that, Senator, I'm not going to stop you.
All right, let's move on to the bad martini now. And this is the New York Times version of the story. The House Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act would increase the number of people without health insurance by 24 million by 2026, while slicing $337 billion off federal budget deficits over that time, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office Monday. Republicans had been bracing for what was almost certain to be a bleak accounting of the legislation's projected effects. The American Health Care Act, as Republicans call their bill, was already facing widespread criticism from health care providers, some conservatives, and the United Democratic Party. So, Jim, it's always fun when people get results they like from the Congressional Budget Office. They are the seer of seers and knower of all things. When they don't like it, what do they know? They've gotten things wrong in the past. It's fun to watch the media on this as well. Yes, 14 million fewer people might have health insurance by 2018. But if you look into the finer print, most of those would be people who wouldn't have it now if they weren't forced to buy it. And the cost curve does start bending down within a couple of years. So not endorsing the bill, but looking here at interesting coverage and numbers that are not going to make it any easier.
The Congressional Budget Office, a bunch of troublemakers with slide rules. What? Oh, you and your math, you eggheads! Sure. Here is one of the. Actually, I was when Paul Ryan said, "Actually, this report isn't as bad as we thought." Everybody started scoffing, but everybody kind of ignores the fact that it does say it's going to reduce the deficit quite considerably. Now, one of the arguments, or one of the factions that wasn't such a big fan, was the Republican Policy Committee, and kind of the more the fiscal conservatives, the fiscal hawks in the GOP House, who basically thought, this, replacing one system of entitlements with another, this isn't really moving the ball in the direction in terms of shrinking government and reducing expenses. So from their minds, the CBO is actually pretty good. All of a sudden, the CBO has given Paul Ryan this, hey, you remember when we thought we weren't stingy enough? Here you go. The bad news is that obviously this number of the uninsured. Now, some of this includes people who, when they say you're going to lose your coverage, under Obamacare, you are being forced to buy coverage that you might otherwise you otherwise might not want to, but you want to avoid the tax penalty. So if they take away the individual mandate, some people are going to stop buying insurance. Does this count as they join the ranks of the uninsured? Yes, because they chose to. Right? We can argue about whether that's a wise decision or a bad decision. But if you think that one of the core problems with Obamacare was this idea that the government was making you do something, we have decided for your own good, you have to buy this product, whether you like it or not, whether you want it or not. Then this is an inevitable side effect of any reform that gets rid of the individual mandate. So there's a part of it. I guess the reason this is a bad martini is that there is no Obamacare reform that's going to leave everybody happy, and there is no Obamacare reform that's going to leave every Republican happy. And this is what we're seeing with this today. That actually this law, for all the criticism of it, does achieve one of the goals that Republicans set out for it. It does reduce spending. It does stop, Avik Roy, who's had plenty of criticisms about it, says technically this counts as one of the biggest and boldest entitlement reform efforts ever. We haven't really thought about that. Everybody's been hurling tomatoes at this thing. Having said that, people hate entitlement reform because you end up taking stuff away from people, and people do not like having something taken away from them. So this is the rock and a hard place that the Republicans find themselves in. They basically don't have a lot of good options. You could go scrap it and go back to the drawing board, as Senator Tom Cotton does, but then you're going to be in a situation where the attitude is Republicans tried and they have failed. Republicans in disarray. Obamacare is never going to get repealed. Why don't these guys just get it done? Yada, yada, yada. You'll get that criticism. Now, the assessment I found most intriguing from Megan McArdle this morning, wrote about in this morning jolt. Megan McArdle writes from Bloomberg, really gets into the numbers of this. But the short version is, do your best to try to pass this bill. And when it fails, and it's probably going to fail in the Senate, right? You're basically not going to be able to overrule the you're not going to have 60 votes. There's basically not a single Democrat who's going to help with anything to repeal and replace Obamacare. Deep down, like they focus on those first five letters, right? Anything you do to change Obamacare and his admission, the first one was a mistake, and they just will not allow any of that to happen. Well, do your best, and then in a year or two from now, when the exchanges are pretty much in total collapse and more people have one option, or in some case, some states, you may have the point where no option, no insurer finds it worthwhile to operate on the state exchanges, then Republicans would say, look, we tried to fix this, but Democrats wouldn't let us. Democrats insisted we stick with the current system. They insisted we stick with the status quo. Now look where we are. And the Republicans might have better leverage about a year or two from now. This would require about a year's worth of, you know, bad headlines of people saying Republicans failed to repeal it. But this might be the politically least damaging one. Now, the only problem is that with that scenario, you still have to go ahead with the collapse of the exchanges, and lots of people suffer through that way anyway. So, you know, pick your poison, Republicans.
So what we've learned from our early stories here, Jim, is that some people might want to hire. Some people might want to hire new people at the Congressional Budget Office. Other people might want better staffers on the Democratic Senate side of Capitol Hill because they can't find any dirt on Neil Gorsuch. Although if there's nothing to really to find, that's not their fault necessarily. And most importantly, Jim would like to pay someone a very limited amount of money to shovel his driveway today. So a lot of potential jobs out there. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you've got to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can, all at once, because with ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface.
No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, listeners of the 3 Martini Lunch podcast can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free just by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. All right, Jim, let's move on to the crazy Martini now. If you were the victim of an assault, I'm guessing one of the first things you probably wouldn't do was try to get into the minds of the people who assaulted you and figure out maybe why they had a good reason for doing so. But Allison Stanger is a little different. Allison Stanger is the professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College. If you know the story, she had invited Charles Murray of the American Enterprise Institute up for a talk. She says here in this New York Times opinion piece that she disagreed with him, but that's one of the reasons she wanted to bring him up. So she deserves some credit for that. And so ultimately, the original gathering got shouted down by protesters. They moved it, and eventually the protesters found out where they moved it to. And ultimately, Stanger tried to help Dr. Murray get to a vehicle, and she ended up with a concussion because the mob was getting crazy. So she is written now in the New York Times with the headline, "Understanding the Angry Mob at Middlebury That Gave Me a Concussion." So she talks a lot about the actual narrative of the incident, but here's some of what she says also. In the days after the violence, some have spun this story as one about what's wrong with elite colleges and universities, our coddled youth, or intolerant liberalism. Those analyses are incomplete. Political life and discourse in the United States is at a boiling point, and nowhere is the reaction to that more heightened than on college campuses. Throughout an ugly campaign and into his presidency, President Trump has demonized Muslims as terrorists and dehumanized many groups of marginalized people. He declared the free press an enemy of the people, replaced deliberation with tweeting, and seems bent on dismantling the separation of powers and 230 years of progress this country has made toward a more perfect union. Much of the free speech he has inspired, or has refused to disavow, is ugly, and has already had ugly real-world consequences. College students have seen this and have taken note. Speech can become action. Later on, she says, it is obvious that some protesters made dangerous choices, but with time to reflect, I have to say that I hear and understand the righteous anger of many of those who shouted us down. I know that many students felt they were standing up to protect marginalized people who have been demeaned or even threatened under the guise of free speech. She also points out that the protesters found out that Charles Murray was determined to be a person who engages in hate speech from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Big surprise, surprise. Every conservative, they think, is basically a hate group. So, Jim, she does spend a lot of this piece explaining why it was not right to be violent. But taking the time here to say she understands them and even blame Trump for what happened to her is beyond the pale.
Yeah. Now, this woman has already been attacked. And so I kind of want to, you want to respond with sympathy. And you don't want to tell somebody, well, you're reacting to your traumatic event wrong, But having said that, and there's plenty of this that this op-ed in the New York Times that you and I would agree with. You know, she points out that I think the most interesting thing is where she says, you know, how intelligent members of the Middlebury community, including some of my own students' advisees, based on what they were hearing from one another, what they read at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, it's basically she's saying, so a good portion of the crowd was misinformed, including the faculty. Right? So as much as, you know, because I was talking about this with some other National Review editors this morning, and I'm like, you know, God, I can't believe she said this. And this aspect is pointed out to me that she really is kind of quietly trashing her own community. So maybe we shouldn't be that tough on her. But there were a couple phrases that jumped out at me and really kind of rubbed me the wrong way. You might even say I needed a trigger warning. she said that speech can become action. Well, okay, except that gets – and not only that, a little later on, she makes a reference to the Supreme Court case about fighting words. There's a direct line between the fighting words on campus, the suppression of speech, and the angry mob that gave me a concussion. All violence is a breakdown of communication. Well, fighting words is from that Supreme Court case, you know, decades and decades ago, that they're pretty sure would not get upheld today. But this is the where the, you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater comes from. We want to be very careful about how we say, you can't say that because it's automatically going to provoke a violent response in someone. And thus you're basically inviting an assault upon yourself. This is a, if you, you know, even if you're not a First Amendment absolutist like I am, you pretty much don't want somebody to be able to say, well, he said something that really offended me, thus I punched him, and for the law to say, well, that's okay. We may have kind of an unwritten law. We may have a cultural belief that if you say something bad about a guy's mother, he may haul off and slug you. But we really don't want the law to say, nah, that's okay. He had it coming. That's a very dangerous philosophy, because then the definition of offensive becomes really, really elastic, shall we say. Charles Murray should be able to say whatever the heck he wants without the fear that someone is going to physically assault him because of that, right? This is where, you know, when she says, you know, speech can become action. Well, if the speech becomes an action and that it spurs you to register to vote, terrific. If the speech that becomes action is it spurs you to punch someone, then it's not okay. And that's where I don't like this idea that, well, one thing can lead to another, and then, you know, no, no. At some point, someone has to make the conscious choice that I want to use my fist to punch that person or grab that person. Or in her description, she grabbed hold of her hair. Others are shoving me. I feared for my life. Protesters climbed on it. I'm still wearing a neck brace and spent a week in a dark room to recover from a concussion caused by the whiplash. I will put aside, Greg, any suggestion that the lack of logic in her op-ed stems from the after effects of the concussion. Nonetheless, this is, if the NFL has concussion protocols, maybe academia needs it as well. You shouldn't be writing these types of arguments until they've checked you out. Again, I don't want to attack this woman. I feel like she, you know, deserves sympathy. But then I'm kind of struck by the lack of anger of the people who physically assaulted her. Greg, as far as we know, none of these people have been arrested. No student has faced any kind of disciplinary action from the university. This is not like general bad behavior or uncouth. This is a crime. It is against the law to attack someone physically. Verbally, fair game. Say whatever you want to say. And there's this real blurring of this line. And the fact that she kind of – that line that really sticks in my head, you know, I hear and understand the righteous anger of many of those who shouted us down. Look, I don't know if I want to see victims saying to their attackers, I sympathize and understand. I don't want you to sympathize and understand. Ma'am, I want you to get angry. I'm angry on your behalf. You shouldn't have had to go through that. So I know she may see it as complicated and nuanced and all of that. And, you know, her general message of urging people to engage civilly with one another, you know, terrific. Fine. I completely applaud that. But deep down, Greg, in this, because I don't really see any calling for consequences of those who made the decision to use violence to make their point. And I kind of feel like that's really a key point that shouldn't be missing from this. And unnerving to indicate that within the academic community, yes, there's been a widespread denunciation of the angry mob. But without consequences, I think you're only going to get more of it.
Jim, I can't say it any better. Can't really add anything to that. So well done. Good luck dealing with the half of inch of snow, and we'll see how things stand in Northern Virginia tomorrow.
Send sled dogs.
Jim Carity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Remember also that Three Martini Lunch podcast listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial and join us again on Wednesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.